Welcome back, everybody. It's time again to the Private Investing and Business Hour on OC Talk Radio, where we discuss the insider information that you need to know about raising capital in today's changing environment. So if you're an investor, an entrepreneur, pull up a chair, slip off your shoes, and let's get started here with our host. The host today, Jim Butts from CalCap Partners.
Well, thanks, Paul. Today I'm here with Audrey Chernick. And Aubrey Chernick. He is currently founder of what's Next Gen Crowdfunding that I'm going to have you explain about. And then he's also done some other things with other companies. I've also done some things with philanthropy. So, Aubrey, welcome to the show. Why don't you take a couple minutes and tell people who you are and what you're all about?
Great. Jim, thanks for having me today. It's good to be on your show. Well, I'm an entrepreneur. I started when I was 26 years old. I created a company, a software company called Campbell Corporation. So I know that entrepreneurial spirit and the peaks and valleys of what entrepreneurs go through. Back in my time, software was pretty new. I developed a software product to analyze those big IBM mainframe computers. I didn't have any investment. I bootstrapped the whole company. No outside investors. So I was very, very fortunate. And I grew the business over time to a couple thousand people and a couple $100 million. And was very fortunate after 30 years to sell it to IBM. But I was very, very lucky. And I know today there's many entrepreneurs, of course, that need capital to expand their business. So it's a real challenge for them. So I've been lucky. I've been successful. And so I have interest in part to see how I can help out other entrepreneurs. And that's really the motivation in terms of this new venture, Next Gen Crowdfunding, because crowdfunding is going to be an important dynamic, a potentially transformational dynamic for the future of equity funding for startup companies and for emerging businesses.
I actually think it's a great thing to be involved with. I mean, the thing that really annoys me about this, the whole structure of how this operates is, if you listen to the Kauffman Center for Entrepreneurial Research out in Kansas City, which is pretty well respected, they basically tell you that not one net new job is created by companies more than 5 years old. That's a very interesting number, and I've said that to people, and they say, well, you know, last year General Motors hired 25,000 people, and I say, great, when they hire the other 500,000 that they laid off, the next person that they hire will be in a net job. You would think that if that was so important, there would be tons of money for people to be able to get, but there isn't. You know, there's SBA-backed loans, but they're not for startups because they want to have companies that have been involved for 2 years and they've got some background and some credit history, or they want them to put up personal property as guarantees. There's just not a lot of money around for these people. And if you really look at where job creation comes from, it really comes from that, you know, that 5 years. It's the last 2.5 years, not the first 2.5 years. So you got to get them to the point where they can grow. And there's not a sufficient amount of capital that's in there. But when I heard about the crowdfunding space, I thought it was great. It's just that it's taking so long for all of the government regulations to come about. Where do we sort of stand? Well, first of all, why don't you take a minute, because there may be some people that don't understand what we're talking about. Tell people what crowdfunding is.
Sure. So crowdfunding has gone and is going through an incredible evolution. It started in 2009, really, with Kickstarter and other companies such as Indiegogo that provided, of course, what's called reward-based crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. And this is an environment, a mechanism by which people can help small companies by pre-purchasing a product that maybe the company is going to build in the next, 9 months or so.
Right.
So it's called rewards-based. They didn't provide any equity.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big business. I think this last year, Kickstarter did about $500 million in business they facilitated of reward-based Kickstarter-oriented donations. So what does this mean? It means there's a lot of people out there spending, who knows, maybe $1 billion not to invest, not to get a financial return, but to sometimes get an emotional return because they want to support these small companies. So the government wanted to facilitate, other people wanted to facilitate, a way in which people could actually invest in these small companies, not just for rewards, but for equity. And so the government created this process, this mechanism called the Jobs Act.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, they had three different flavors of crowdfunding that they had considered. And the first one was called Title II, then Title IV, and then Title III. And if you like, I'll go through each of these really briefly.
Sure.
Okay. So the first stage, Title II, it allowed equity investing in small companies, but it was limited to accredited investors. There's maybe 8.5 accredited investors. So this concept can be kind of a mind-bending thing. Why? Because when you think about crowdfunding, you think about millions and millions of people putting in a small amount of money. The people that support reward-based Kickstarter, they're not necessarily accredited investors.
Right.
And so when Title II came along, oh, it's crowdfunding, equity crowdfunding, et cetera, you think, well, it's for average investors, entry-level investors. But it wasn't. It was for the wealthy accredited investors. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of a disconnect, a cultural, social, economic disconnect from the populist nature, you might say, of reward-based crowdfunding and the more, you know, high-end nature of the initial equity crowdfunding under Title II.
Mm-hmm.
So the Title II implementation began, I believe, in September of 2013. Now, at the same time, the government was working on two other measures for equity crowdfunding that would include unaccredited investors. The big one was Title III, and they also were working on Title IV. For whatever reason, the government needed more time to figure out how to create Title III. So Title IV came out before. Title IV was announced this spring and became effective on June 19th. Title III, this is really timely, tomorrow, which is as of today, it's tomorrow, October 30th,
mm-hmm.
FCC is going to vote on Title III. And assuming that their vote is going to be thumbs up, Title III will probably become effective in January of 2016. So that's the sequence. Title II for accredited, then Title IV for unaccredited as of this summer, and then in January, Title III for unaccredited, et cetera. So you have one program for accredited and these two programs for unaccredited investors.
So I found that to be somewhat interesting in the way that this has all evolved. Because accredited investors, I mean, if you think about someone like, if we were in Southern California, so you see angel groups like Tech Coast Angels or Pasadena Angels or Maverick Angels, they actually work effectively like crowdfunding because they have a group of people who put money together and do it as a single investment in most respects. So I think that, you know, some of that had already been known, so that wasn't really the big problem. The big problem was, as you said, how do you get people to the point where you can have, you know, 5,000 people donate money and get equity, and they're not accredited? Actually, Dodd-Frank killed accreditation for a lot of people because they made your primary residence not to be included in your $1 million worth of self-worth. So it sort of it killed a lot of people who were even angel investors did. All of a sudden, they were making it based upon their value of their primary residence. So I think that was all interesting. And to be honest with you, things like Kickstarter, Indiegogo was usually doing a lot of things with projects for like literary art. And I actually donated money to somebody. They were trying to finish a documentary about a specific organization in Vietnam, and I happened to be in that organization. So I was donating to that. But people got confused about Kickstarter, and they did raise a ton of money. I mean, Pebble Watch, I think they did like $10 million. I mean, it was an incredible amount of money. But again, people got confused because they thought, well, why is the government even thinking about this? We already have it because there are these things like Kickstarter. And it was like, no, they were just buying a product as opposed to investing. What's going to come out tomorrow? Are you aware of what this looks like?
Yeah, so it may be useful for your listeners to understand the difference between these two types of equity crowdfunding that are becoming available for unaccredited investors. So the first one that came out, and there's all these geeky names that makes it really confusing. So the first one that came out June 19th is called Title IV, also called Reg A+, meaning Regulation A+. What was that about? That's a vehicle by which a company, an emerging company, could be a startup, can raise up to $50 million on a national basis. To make it a little bit more confusing, Reg A has Tier 1 and Tier 2.
Right.
Tier 2 is the national one for $50 million. Tier 1 is the state one for $20 million. But to simplify it, we can talk about Tier 2. National, they can raise up to $50 million, etc. There is a hurdle that an entrepreneur has to jump through. That's less hurdle than becoming a public company, but still a reasonably sized hurdle. This company, if they want to file with the SEC and get that filing qualified or approved by the SEC, they will have to have audited financials, and they'll have to work with a security attorney. And the estimated cost for a small company to have their financials audited and to file their application, called the 1A application, is about $40,000 to $50,000. So it's not hundreds of thousands of dollars, but it's still relatively significant, etc. So because they have the ability to raise up to $50 million, there's a hurdle they have to pass through. Okay, the government did allow something really, really interesting for Regulation A+, which is the ability for these small, for these mid-sized companies that want to raise $1 million to $50 million to test the waters. It's called TTW, or test the waters. And what it means is for the small company that doesn't know if they want to not only spend this money on getting their books audited, going, doing a filing with the SEC, and maybe they don't know whether they want to open up the kimono and divulge all their secrets to their competition, and maybe they don't want to be embarrassed in terms of reputational damage if their raise doesn't go well, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The government created this capability called testing the waters, in which a Reg A company, they don't have to file with the SEC. They can create some marketing material. It has to be truthful. Can't be fraudulent, obviously. Should not have hyperbole in it because it's going to get reviewed by the SEC. And this material can be put on different websites, and they can get an expression of interest from the user, from the participant. There's an SEC disclosure that will be on there that says they're not asking for money, and it doesn't mean that the company is going to actually do a public filing. So it's an intermediate way for startups that want to do a significant raise. So that's kind of the soup to nuts of Title IV. Big money, bigger hurdle. Title III is geared a little bit more towards startups. You can only raise $1 million, but as a result, the hurdles that you have to jump through are a lot less significant. And I don't want to go into the details of what that is, but basically, Title IV is for bigger raises with companies with a little bit more maturity, although startups can use it also. Whereas Title III, hopefully being voted on October the 30th, Friday, and hopefully operational in January of this year, it's really going to unleash lots and lots of smaller companies, startups, entrepreneurs going after investments from consumers, entry-level investors. And that level of those investments for Title IV and Title III could be as low as perhaps $200 or $300.
That's kind of interesting to hear also. So I know you don't want to discuss too much about what's happening with the Title III, but I understand, because we do have a number of people to listen that would be at that early stage startup perspective. There was a couple different perspectives that you could use in there. One of them, you had to file with each individual state that you were going to want to raise money in, and the other one you weren't. Is that still in the plan?
That's certainly been an issue for Title IV.
Right.
And the states really wanted to make sure that they got a piece of the action. So what the federal government did is it kind of bifurcated the whole plan, and a lot of people were surprised at this, frankly. Because basically, the federal government created, again, for Title IV, Tier 1 that is state-friendly.
Right.
Meaning, if you only want to do a filing in a few states, then you just have to file with those states. Mm-hmm. But you have to deal with each of those states individually. So right. that's the issue.
Right.
And then the federal government created this higher level under Reg A, which is Tier 2, which is a national filing, and that preempts and bypasses all the states. The states are not happy with that. Not all the states are happy. Well, some are objecting to this, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But basically, in Reg A, there's those two different mechanisms that you have, Tier 1 and Tier 2. Tier 2 is the national mechanism.
Yeah, from the entrepreneur's standpoint, the last thing it's difficult enough to deal with one entity. But if you were in Southern California and you were going to be raising money, and you know that there's states around you, whether they're north or east of you, you know, you're going to Oregon or Washington or Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada especially, if you're going to have to file with each of those states, it's more effort and you know, you got a company that what they're trying to do is get themselves up and running, and to do all that individualism just didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I know the states are in there for a different reason, but from the entrepreneur standpoint, it's good that the government came in and said, look, there's a different way for you to be able to do that. So I think that was smart on their part. So what is your view about longer term? What do you think that this is going to look like, this crowdfunding? Let's say for, you know, next 2 to 5 years.
Well, personally, I think that equity crowdfunding is going to be a transformational event, you know, for our economy, for a number of different reasons. So I think the impact could be, you know, extremely profound.
One of the questions that a lot of people had was, you know, will there be too much money around? Will there be too many failures? And although maybe that's true, the number of companies that get started, I'm trying to remember the exact numbers of the, you know, like every year there's like 500,000 businesses that are created, but every year 500,000 businesses fail, which is why we don't all of a sudden see we got 200 million companies in the United States. But this whole idea of if you could have another entity that would allow somebody to have some conversations with some people that don't have $100,000 or $200,000 to contribute, but like what you're doing and contribute $5,000 or $10,000 or less, I think that's great. Are there any restrictions on the amount of money that people can contribute when you're looking at these?
Well, of course, if you're an unaccredited investor, then I believe you're limited in terms of how much you can invest.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's to 10%. And, of course, as you said, there's these formulas that are out there in terms of how do you count your assets, you know, without your house, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, there are limits in terms of what an unaccredited investor can invest, because the government doesn't want you to take all this risk on. You know, investing in any early stage companies, startups or early stage companies, obviously is more risky.
Yeah.
You know, any angel investor, they want to be on the leading edge, if not the cutting edge, as they call it, as we know. So there's a higher risk profile the earlier you get in there, and then as the business develops and it gets more traction, track record, etc. I mean, you know, the valuation changes and the risk, you know, decreases. So there's a risk profile. And for entry level, you know, when we take a look at unaccredited investors, it's really interesting because there's going to be different types. There's not one unaccredited investors. There's going to be very experienced unaccredited investors that are extremely knowledgeable. They've invested in the marketplace. They've studied this. They're really professionals. They just don't happen to have the wealth that the 8.5 million accredited investors have.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's other unaccredited investors that aren't familiar with the word investing at all. They might not even see themselves initially as investors. They might be crowdfunding donors, and over time they may become crowdfunding owners. They may not know the word, what the word unaccredited means, angel investor means, etc. So they are new. And not everyone that enters this area is necessarily looking for a financial return.
Hmm.
So that might sound strange, but, you know, if you've been on reward-based crowdfunding, you've been giving a few hundred dollars to Kickstarter,
mm-hmm.
you're trying to help a small company. Well, there's a transition. There will be a certain number of people that say, you know, I've helped them before, you know, with reward-based money. Now I'm going to help them as an owner of the company, as an investor into the company, etc. And that's going to be a very powerful, you know, element. As I said, I think this whole area is going to be transformational. I think it's going to be transformational for, you know, four or five different reasons. But one of the reasons is it's going to be a new way for the average investor to really help the little guy, the little company that wants to chase the American dream, and to be part of that team. So the amount they might invest, again, it doesn't have to be $10,000. It doesn't have to be $5,000. It might be a few hundred dollars.
Right.
So for some people, if they triple their money and they put in $200 or $300, or if they lose their money, it's not necessarily as materially going to affect them as it would be if they were putting in a lot of money.
Right.
So we need to make sure that when we're taking a look at these unaccredited investors, we realize that there's a spectrum of them. Some of them are new, they're entry level, and some of them are really experienced. Some will look at this from an emotional point of view. Some will say, well, what's the return? What's the due diligence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and they'll look at it more from a financial point of view.
Well, you know, this is, just to let you know how interesting this is, we're just about at the end of this segment. I know that, I believe that you're going to be involved in a financial forum in the near future.
Yes, we're having an incredible conference on November 19th in Santa Monica. We're putting a conference that is about crowdfunding, equity crowdfunding. We call it the new era. It's being put on by NextGen Crowdfunding. We're going to have amazing speakers, industry-leading speakers there. Some are on our advisory board. So these are the top brains, legal people, other people. We'll have crowdfunding platforms that are there. We'll have different campaigns that are talking about their campaigns there. We'll talk about it from an entrepreneurial point of view as well as from an investor point of view.
Great. And if somebody wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
www.nextgencrowdfunding.com.
Great. It was really a pleasure talking with you. I thought that it was really great, and I look forward to maybe having you back on another segment that we can continue this conversation.
Yes, there's one more thing that would be really great to talk about, because I think you're a VC, am I right, Jim?
Yes, yep.
So the key issue is, to what degree, Jim, is equity crowdfunding going to really put VCs out of business, or are they simply going to be marginalized? That's a good thing, I think, to ponder for another call.
Well, we'll definitely talk about that, because that's an interesting conversation. Thanks so much for doing the interview today.
Great. Thanks so much, Jim.
So let's do a shout out to the sponsor of today's program, CalCap Partners. CalCap Partners is the manager of venture capital funds specializing in investing in kind of what we're talking about today, small to medium-sized technology-based businesses with high growth potential. CalCap manages equity and debt investments into companies that meet the investment criteria of our various funds. Managers of previous investment transactions collectively exceeding U.S. $2 billion. That's what they bring to the table here. And operations in the U.S., California, New York, Canada, including Ontario and British Columbia. And they include a global network of strategic resources consisting of managerial talent and capital resources that truly add value to our portfolio companies. For more information on all the things that they provide and all the things that they do and the funds that they work with, why not just visit the website, CalCap Partners, that's plural, CalCapPartners, CalCapPartners.com. And now back to our show.
A couple of months ago, I had a segment that I did with one of my partners, Mark Burton, where we were answering questions from the mailbag. And one of the questions that came in was asking about the concept of crowdsourcing and crowdfunding. And I thought it would be appropriate that I replay that segment right now. If you're listening to this and you want to fast forward to the part about the crowdfunding, it's about halfway through, about the 13-minute mark. So hopefully this will work and you can hear what we thought about it back then and see the way that it's evolved and the way that Aubrey describes it.
And welcome everybody back to the second segment. As I mentioned, I'm here with my partner, Mark Burton, and we're answering some questions from the mailbag. We just had a pretty good discussion about whether or not you should be an LLC or a C-Corp in Wyoming versus Nevada. We had a similar question from Michelle Green. I think that the answers are going to be the same. But her question is, my partners and I are starting a company or getting conflicting advice about whether it should be an LLC or a corporation. Also, we've heard that we should establish the company in a tax-friendly state like Nevada, Wyoming, or South Dakota. I mean, you might have some comments on South Dakota. But I think this is just a little bit of a switch on it. The question mark that says, you know, conflicting advice about whether it should be an LLC or it should be a corporation. And I'm assuming that you would be able to say that depending upon the business entity you're going into and what you're going to be doing, it makes more sense to be one versus the other. What would you say?
To a degree, yes. You know, it depends on the industry that you're going to be involved with. It depends on, frankly, what state you're in. My question here is, what conflicting advice are you getting? Is it the difference between you're a lawyer and your CPA? Or is it just kind of business advisors? Because really the two things that you should be looking at, folks, the two biggest elements in entity choice are, first, what is the corporate shield protection that I'm getting? What's the liability protection I'm getting? And then against that, what are the tax benefits? And you've got to weigh these two, because every state has their own statutes on each of these. And so you will see differing levels of protection and tax advantage on a state-by-state basis. Now, certainly, on one hand, we have a pretty good idea in general what's going to happen tax-wise at the federal level. That's uniform across the country. What we're concerned about here is what the state taxes are going to look like. Mm-hmm. And those can be wildly differing. This is why you get issues like Nevada saying, hey, you know, we don't have an income tax. Come use us. We're great. And that goes back to my earlier comments of saying, well, that's wonderful. And if you're doing business in Nevada, hey, do it. Great. However, if you're in California and you're a Nevada entity, first you have to go through the hoops of registering as a foreign corporation or a foreign LLC. And then the reality is you're still paying taxes on your revenues. That doesn't change. If any business that's generated in California, you're paying tax on. Amazingly, politicians and the government just love taxes, so they're not going to let you get away easily. And by the way, that's another thing to think about. When you're choosing these other entities and you're going into business in a state, don't only look to what does the income tax or the capital gains tax look like, but look to things along the lines of what does the sales tax look like? How every state has to make money to run. So every state has taxes. So typically, not always, but typically, when you see a lowering of one type of tax, there's other taxes that are going to offset that. You need to think about that.
You know, the only thing that I would add to this is that, and by the way, I'm completely out of my league, so as a lawyer, you can answer it, you can correct me on anything. One of the issues with being an LLC is all parties in the LLC have the ability to stop something. If you've got a minority person that owns like 2% and they don't like something, they can stop the whole process. Whereas if you're in a C corp, people are just shareholders and they don't, you know, somebody that's a minority stake can't stop anything. So I'm not sure how all that works, but you might know more about that, Mark.
Well, it really depends upon what the operating
agreement is. Yeah, right.
Yeah, you know, it's you made a general statement that's fair enough, but the nice thing about the LLC, the reason why so many people love it, is the fact that you can really do some modifications to the Uniform LLC Act in your state. And again, folks, every state has its own Uniform Limited Liability Company Act or statute. That being said, it's a very flexible entity.
It is.
And there's good and there's bad. The good is you get to change control issues, distribution issues, operating issues. The bad side is that we don't have that many years of precedence in any state. I believe the oldest LLCs are around 30 or 35 years old. And we do have very different statutes in every state regarding the LLC. My biggest fear when I first started practicing law about 20 years ago, and when the LLC was a much, much earlier entity, and we didn't really know much about it, was finding myself in a situation where a client had an LLC. They went into court, and the court said, hey, you know what? We don't agree this is an LLC. this doesn't meet our state's requirements for an LLC, and therefore, we're going to treat you like a partnership and your personal assets are at stake. And at the exact same time, having the state government say, hey, you know what? You don't really look like an LLC as far as we're concerned either. So we're going to treat you like a C corporation because you didn't file an S election, and we're going to double tax you. I couldn't think of a worse situation.
Great. Now, do you happen to have any feelings one way or other, another over South Dakota?
Not really. South Dakota has been on the horizon for a while. Yeah. You know, I'm going to keep going back to that same statement that all of these states that are coming up with these various tax, what do you want to call them, schemes? Sounds a little bad. All of these tax strategies to encourage businesses to come in. These haven't been around very long. We really don't know what the courts are going to say at the federal or state levels. And just because the governor and the legislature have had this brilliant idea that creating this kind of tax strategy is going to bring in more business does not mean the court system, which tends to be more conservative, is going to go along with it.
Mm-hmm. That's a good discussion on that subject. You had brought up a question that you wanted to talk about in reference to minority investors. So why don't you position a question and then give your thoughts on it?
I get asked a lot, and this seems like the perfect show to address it on. The rights of a minority investor when they are either suing the company in which they invested in, or what happens if they're on the sidelines? What should they do? The first thing that I always kind of point out is that it depends on what state you're in. But what we're really talking about to a large degree is a valuation issue. Now, if I say to you, let's say we've got John. John owns 10% of a $10 million company. Mm-hmm. Well, your first thought is, hey, John has $10 million. You know, he can get $1 million if he wants to rescind his agreement, basically. And something's gone very wrong. And he sues, and he says, I want my money back. I want you to pay me out. I want my 10%. You think, well, he gets $1 million. Well, that's not accurate. Hmm. The first thing we look at is something called a minority shareholder discount on the valuation. And what that says is John doesn't have control. He really can't affect anything. So we're not going to give him as much. We're not going to give him his full 10%. The IRA, by the way, a lot of people use this as a tax strategy, folks, and I'll encourage you, if you have minority shareholders, I'd encourage you to talk to your CPA about this. But typically, the IRS has said 32% is about the discount that we like at the maximum level. So our first thought is, oh gosh, I'm so sorry, John, you're not going to get $1 million, you're going to get about $680,000. And then we come up with a new thought. And this is particularly popular in states like California, which are theoretically very progressive. It says, folks, we're not going to look to what we call fair market value, i.e. 10% of a $10 million company is $1 million minus a discount. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a new standard that we call fair value. And that's the value that the investor anticipated in getting when he invested. Mm-hmm. And this is what really scares me about California, when people talk about creating a California company and using California law. This is why I say, no. Go to Delaware, use Delaware law. They don't buy into this that much. So John says, gosh, you know what? I was pretty clear that I expected a 5x return on investment. That's what I was looking for. It was clear. I can show you that. So that valuation now goes from $1 million or even $680,000, we're going to have to multiply that times 5, and that's what the company's going to owe them. That's going to kill them. Now, what do you do if you're the shareholder, you know, minority shareholder on the side? You're going to feel very, very threatened. All of a sudden, along comes John, and he's telling you, well, the company's worth $10 million, and with my 10%, I'm going to walk away with somewhere between 45 and 50% of the value of this company. In other words, I'm going to put you out of business. Very scary. Now, there's no clear answer to this, of course. It depends on the circumstances that led John to sue. One option, of course, is you join John and you say, gosh, yeah, management has really screwed us. We need to take action against him. This isn't what we signed up for. On the other side of the coin, you may want to, in some way, work with management to fight John off. That could mean anything from taking a bigger stake in the company to help fund litigation, all the way over to testifying against John and saying, you know, John never said these things, or, you know, I was there with John when he went ahead and enrolled in this investment, and we heard the same things. So what John is saying now, that management lied, isn't true. What you do need to do, though, as a minority investor who is not yet active in litigation, is retain counsel and find out, hey, what your rights are. More importantly, how to assess John's case. Where do you think it's going to end up? And then you need to start making decisions in conjunction with your counsel. Do not rely on management. Don't rely on John. Don't rely on their counsel. And don't rely on corporate counsel. You must get your own counsel to go ahead and take a look at what's happening.
Yeah, that's really a good explanation of what was going on. I mean, the other thing that seems entirely possible, given the way that they're coming up with this fair market value, you know, if somebody were to to do that and actually force the company could go into bankruptcy, which would then mean that all the debtors would be paid first, and it could end up that everybody loses everything except for the debtors getting their money back.
John is going to be one of those debtors now, isn't he?
Yeah, but would somebody get 3.8 million out of it? I have no idea, but it's just another one of those things that it's better to be prepared for than to get caught short on. So it's a good explanation. We have one other question that, and it's good. We have about 10 minutes left or 9 minutes left to talk about because it's an interesting question. It came from Bob Hurley of Sherman Oaks, California. I hear much about crowdfunding now, but I'm not sure what it is. Selling shares of my company or discounted products, is it a good financing alternative for an early stage company? This is one of these things that there's just so many things going on. By the way, there was some recent announcements this last week that the SEC has come along and has decided about how crowdfunding may work for non-accredited investors. I'll talk a little bit about that in a couple minutes, but most of it isn't quite known yet. It's one of these things where they've come to some agreements, and 60 days after it's registered, it becomes a law. But there's a lot of things that have to be rolled out about it. So I couldn't talk about it definitively since I just read about it earlier today. Let's talk about the concept, though, of crowdfunding. And there's a lot of misconceptions about it. And in looking at it a little bit today, I saw that there were three types of crowdfunding operations. There was the crowdfunding for equity that you're starting to hear about nowadays. And then the next thing that you would hear of is the ones like the Kickstarter programs, which are reward-based crowdfunding operations. Mm-hmm. And then the third one is called credit-backed. And these have been around for a while, and it's probably the easiest to explain. So credit-backed crowdsourcing were non-banks putting together money and lending it out. And this actually started before the 2008-2009 crash where banks weren't lending out any money. There were consortiums of people who banded together and loaned out money, and they actually did fairly well. And you don't hear about that, and I didn't realize that they were still calling that a form of crowdfunding, but they are. The ones that you hear about a lot, because they've been around for a while and there's been a lot of stuff happening with it, are the ones that you're doing that are reward-based. And these are the Kickstarter programs or the Indiegogo programs. And you're not actually buying any part of the company, but there are companies that have funded themselves very well. I think one of the first ones was Pebble Watch that, you know, they came up with $10 million. I think they just ran another program where they raised another $20 million. But they're doing it not by taking money for shares of stock. They're doing it by selling products ahead of time. The one that caused the most rift last year was, and I use the word rift, was Oculus and their Oculus Rift product. And they raised about $2.4 million in a Kickstarter program back in March of 2014. And it was just to buy products. So whatever devices that they were creating, there were people that paid ahead of time to get those devices. A short time later during the year, they were acquired by Facebook for $2 billion. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of the people that were in this, you know, Kickstarter program that thought that, well, since their money got them to the point where they were of interest to Facebook, they should somehow benefit in this $2 billion. And, of course, they didn't because they don't own any shares of stock. It caused some really ill feelings. But the biggest issue with this is that if you're in one of these programs, you're not buying the company. You're not investing in the company. You're trading your money for something else. And the difference between some of these programs, Kickstarter, you're generally doing it for a product. There's another platform called Indiegogo that a lot of what they were doing was raising money for the arts. There was a market brought up, we were talking about this during the break, market brought up the fact that Veronica Mars, which was a very popular TV show, they wanted to finish a movie, and they didn't have enough money to do it, so they ran a program through Indiegogo and raised enough money to finish the movie. And at the end, people did the raising, you know, they got something for it, but it wasn't, you know, any money from the film. It was some sort of a trash or trinket that was associated with it. And I had mentioned that I had run into somebody that were trying to do a documentary on a specific event in the Vietnam War called Quezon, and I was interested in it because it was 26 Marines. I was with 26 Marines after they left Quezon, and the guy was trying to finish it, so I donated some money. And I would get things like, as they were getting ready to finish it up, I would get a poster for what the movie looked like. I was willing to do that. I thought that was interesting. But there's no way that I would participate in any earnings or losses from that investment. Do you have anything you want to add to that, Mark?
Well, I find the entire concept very interesting. And I think under the right set of circumstances and for the right purpose, it's a great concept. But I'm very specific as to where I find it appropriate. And I find it appropriate from a business kind of standpoint. I find it appropriate for the arts, really, for the Veronica Mars situation. That's great. I also find it great for philanthropy, by the way, and there are some philanthropy platforms out there. I think it's fantastic for them as well. Mm-hmm. Where I become concerned is when you're a non-entertainment, non-philanthropy business. And Jim, if you remember, obviously I'm not going to give the name out. There was a company that you, I, and John were looking at.
Right.
A while back, right? And they had a very interesting, very cool product, and they decided that they were going to crowdfund rather than go the more traditional route with us. The result was that they promised product to the people who were funding them. Mm-hmm. Well, here we are 3 years later, and yes, they raised a fair amount of money, but the problem is all of the money they raised keeps going back into buying product to quote-unquote pay off the people that gave them money.
Right.
They haven't gotten anywhere. And that's a huge concern. You've literally just gone from trying to raise money to grow your company to doing nothing but to raise money to pay off the investors. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, in some cases there were some things there were some side effects that happened. For example, the people with Pebble Watch, one of the things that was very beneficial about them was they built the watches themselves when they first did this campaign. And what they found was in building the watches, they actually started to modify it because there were components that weren't fitting together really well. And they learned more about, by the time they were done, they put together a really great product because they did that. But that was not anything that they went into with the idea that it would happen. It was just something that happened and the product benefited from it. The other kind of crowdfunding you're hearing about, and you're going to hear more about it, is this crowdfunding to have a group of people that will do investing for equity in companies. Now, the Jobs Act of 2012 came up with the idea that we should pursue this more, because if you're looking at, you know, where do most net new jobs come from? They come from early stage companies less than 5 years old. And based upon a lot of work that we've done, we know that that doesn't happen during the first 2.5 years because companies are just really getting there and getting started. It's the last 2.5 years where they have really aggressive growth plans and they sort of really grow. So getting money for that group of people, especially after 2008, 2009, has been very difficult and continues to be very difficult. Mm-hmm. So having this consortium or pool of people that would contribute money is a really good thing. The first thing that they dealt with was, are they, you know, there's something called an accredited investor. And an accredited investor, there's a certain number of rules. And as an individual, you have to make over $200,000 a year for the past 3 years each year. Or you have to have a net worth greater than $1 million. But in that $1 million, you can't include your primary residence. So that's a step to get over. I think that they say there's about 8 million people in the United States that qualify as accredited investors in that case. Now, for those people, they put together a program, and that was like Title I in this whole strategy of it, and it was really only for accredited investors. Or actually, no, Title I was self-generated by the companies. Title II was only for accredited investors. They worked on something called Title III, and they screwed it up so much that they just decided to drop it. Because there was, you know, you get this idea between the federal government and the state governments, and in the federal government, it's the Securities and Exchange Commission, and in the state governments, it's this thing called NASA, which is the National Association of Subscription, whatever the AA stands for. They set up a lot of rules, and it ended up that there was a basis that was put together by the SEC under Title III. And then all of a sudden an ASAA came in and started to add more things to protect the investor, and it ended up being untenable, so they sort of dropped it.
Wait, Jim, you mean that the government actually managed to screw itself up and not actually achieve its goals?
Well, it wasn't. So you have to ask the question, which government was it that did it? Because the SEC actually came out with something, and then it was NASAA that came out and said that, no, wait a minute, we got to go do something different. We got to add all these things in it. And it ended up, North American Securities Administration Association is this organization, and they do it state by state.
Jim, so, I'm going to add something right in here that's ancillary to the question, but it's important for those members of your audience that are out there looking at raising capital to understand.
Yep.
And that is that the majority of the members of an agency, whether it's the SEC or the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, whoever, don't necessarily understand the transactions that they are overseeing. They understand the statutes and the regulations. And this becomes a really big problem, folks, because if you move away from the letter of the statute or regulation, these folks don't know what to do, and their first instinct is to go ahead and say, let's do an enforcement action against them, regardless of whether they're right or wrong.
That's actually good to note. And by the way, there's going to be more about this coming. We're going to talk about this more on another show as more comes out that we can actually talk on it. But just understand that there is this this Title IV that's really targeted towards non-accredited investors, and you're going to see more about crowdfunding, but we happen to be out of time. So, Mark, thanks for being part of the show, and we'll learn more about this, and we'll add it to, if not the general mailbag, we'll add it to our own mailbag and have a further conversation about this in the future. Care.
You've been listening to the only show that talks about the real-world examples, the real-life stories of venture capitalists today. It's California Business Investing Hour, brought to you by CalCap Partners, right here in Orange County's only community radio station, OC Talk Radio.